You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards. Today I sit down with writer, director, and actress Lynn Shelton to talk about her new film, Sword of Trust. We talk about her writing process and also her magic formula for making a low-budget indie film. Take a listen. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I should tell my listeners that we're here at the New Art Theater in LA where your film, Sword of Trust, opened last night. Mm-hmm. And you're here because you're going to do a Q&A after tonight's screening, right?
Yes, one after the late matinee, and then I'm coming back to do yet another in the evening.
Fantastic. This movie is so good.
Oh, thank you.
I loved it. It was quirky. It's hilarious. What inspired you to write a film about a guy who owns a pawn shop and gets a sword that may or may not prove that the South won the Civil War?
Well, the plot sort of came last, honestly. Okay. I knew I wanted to make a movie with Marc Maron. I'd been wanting to make a movie with him for years, and in fact, we had been writing another movie for years, and it was going very slowly, and I started to get really frustrated, and he said, well, if you're so hot to trot to make a movie with me, go ahead and write another movie, and I'll show up for you for 2 weeks, and we'll make that one. And I don't think he thought I would do that. But a couple months later, I showed up with a script and said, all right, give me my 2 weeks. And the way that the plot came about was that I was thinking about what kind of character I wanted to see him play, what kind of interesting scenario I wanted to put him in. And I was in a Lyft ride, and it stopped in front of a pawn shop. And I looked over at this pawn shop, and it was just, I could see him in there. He always teases me because it's like, oh, so you saw me among the sad, abandoned objects imbued with all kinds of, you know, sad stories. And I was like, yeah, exactly. I could totally see you back there. Plus, a pawn shop is such a great setting because any kind of oddball character can walk in that door, you know, with an interesting artifact of some sort. And, you know, so it just seemed like a great setting. And then the other factors that I had in mind for this movie were that I really wanted to return to making movies with improvisation, mm-hmm. as giving the actors a lot of freedom for how they find their way through the beats of the scene and a lot of freedom with the dialogue. And I hadn't done that really since my fourth film, Your Sister, Sister. And I'd made three films in between. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. But that was back in 2010. And this is now 2018. And I had been kind of itching to do that again. And I also wanted to make a real funny movie. I was ready to laugh. I'm a big fan of laughing, and my last movie, my seventh film, was called Outside In. I'm very, very, very proud of that film, and I love it to pieces. But it's a drama, and it's the only drama I've ever made. All my other movies have been at least somewhat comedic, and this movie was really kind of heavy, and I was so ready to laugh after that. And I wanted to let myself actually make a screwball comedy or comedy caper, something that went off the rails a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. a la A Fish Called Wanda or Pineapple Express. I specifically wanted real people who you could feel emotionally, were emotionally resonant. They seemed like recognizable human beings that you cared about, to get in over their heads in a really ridiculous kind of comedic fashion. And so Mike O'Brien, I had just met Mike a couple months after I came up with this pawn shop, you know, Mark is a pawn shop broker idea. I met Mike because I was privileged to direct the last episode of his first season of AP Bio, which was a show that he created on NBC and was just renewed after being canceled. Hooray.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, it came back. Yes, exactly. And he got to hang out on set because it was the last show, and he had never been on set before. But we chatted a lot, and we hit it off, and I asked him if he would. First, I asked if he'd be in it, and it ended up he is in it, but for just a very brief cameo, unfortunately, because he couldn't do the fuller role because of AP Bio came back. But he also agreed to co-write it with me, and I don't like sitting alone in a room and writing. I'm not that kind of writer. So I've realized that I'm much better if I have somebody else that I need to feel like I'm accountable to, you know, and we can sort of support each other and figure out those quandaries of narrative in the room together. And it was a great experience. He's just a lovely guy and super easy to collaborate with.
So what was your process like? Did you obviously pitched him the idea. Do you guys sit next to each other? Do you try and make each other laugh? Or do you pass script back and forth?
No, we were there together the whole time. I mean, there were a few times when I live in Seattle and he was in LA, and I was in LA a lot. So we were able to get together for a few sessions like over weekends when I wasn't working or he wasn't working. And then I remember we did have some Google chats. It was the only time I've ever used Google chat or Google Hangout or something. I don't even know what it was. One of those things.
Yep.
It was like a messaging thing. And I think we had, for a while, it was a Google Doc. So we were able to add to it at the same time, like both look at the same document and be like writing at the same time. And that actually worked pretty well. But the best thing of all was when a friend of mine offered us a place, and he was trying to lure us to Kentucky because they have a good tax break there for films. And he said, look, I've got an empty apartment here if you want to come out for a week and write together. Wow. And that was the most productive week of all. Like, we just pounded out basically the whole thing. And we were also, I think we were trying to meet a deadline to get to make the application for the Kentucky film incentive, you know, tax break program or whatever. And so having those little, sort of artificial deadlines are really helpful sometimes. So that really helped because we were sort of up against it. And yeah, we were most productive when we were in the same room together.
That's great.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of Civil War Truthers before. Is that really a thing?
That's because we made it up.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah. But I love the fact that people ask me all the time if it was a real thing, if it's a real thing. And if you think it through, it really makes less than zero sense. But then again, you go online and you look at conspiracy theories that really do exist, and boy, do none of them make any sense at all. So that why far be it for me to say that that's a reason to actually not have it be real. Now, maybe it will be real. I don't know. But I know there are a lot of people who wish the South had won, but I don't know if anybody believes it actually did win. Anyway, so it was actually, the funny thing is I knew I wanted there to be some sort of a con. I thought, well, how, getting into a comedy caper, what if there's like a con? Somebody comes into the shop with some crazy story about something but maybe then the con becomes the conned or whatever, the conner becomes a conned or whatever. Like I wanted some sort of twisty turny kind of thing. So it started with a con idea. And once we were in Kentucky, eventually, we actually moved it to Birmingham, Alabama, but that was fine because it just became a very Southern-based thing. We thought, what about this problematic artifact, you know, that comes with this sort of crazy story? And I already knew I wanted another conspiracy theory in the movie because I'd had this experience with a Lyft driver who turned out to be a flat earther, and I'd never heard of the fact that people were actually believing in that these days. I had no idea. So this was my introduction, was on this ride with this guy who's trying to tell me the earth is flat. And I'm like, okay, well, he can't be serious, obviously. But he really did not seem to be joking. And I was just, it was like my brain could not even wrap around what he was saying. I couldn't believe it because he seemed like a really normal guy. Like, he was a totally normal, intelligent seeming person. And I was just completely befuddled. And at the end of this ride, he parks in front of my apartment. He looks back at me and he says, listen, I know exactly where you are. You were where I was at a year ago. All you got to do is Google it. Just promise me you'll Google it. Because the deeper you go, the more irrefutable it becomes. Oh, it's undeniable. I'm telling you. And he just looked at me and all I could think of was, this is going in a movie. This is so going in a movie. Thank you, sir, because I don't know what is wrong with you, but this is totally going in a movie. And then I've come to find out that it's a whole thing, and there's actually hundreds and thousands of people who actually believe that this is true. So anyway, there you go. Yay! So I knew I wanted that quality in there, but then it's kind of just organically spiraled out. Well, what if there was another conspiracy theory? And then it became the whole sort of broader theme of the movie.
Well, I felt like that's really in the zeitgeist right now.
Oh, my God. Well, we have a conspiracy theorist in chief. I mean, there have always been conspiracy theories, but it's having a peak moment for sure.
Sure. And this isn't his first rodeo with the whole Barack Obama's birth certificate and all of that. I don't know. Anyways, you found a very playful, humorous way to kind of bring that part of what's happening in our culture into the film.
Well, thank you. I wanted to make a culturally relevant movie that would not make you feel like slitting your wrists when you walked out of the theater. That was my goal. I wanted to make a movie that felt of this time, but that allowed you to laugh and not, you know, just feel like doom and despair like I do all the time the rest of my life. You know, I wanted to relieve people and also make them feel sort of validated in their, like, because I feel deeply disturbed by the fact that we're in the post-truth era. And I think a lot of other people are too. And so to know, oh, she's making a satire about this, I can laugh about this with other people who are like-minded, and we all can, like, together, you know. And it's sort of, it's very bonding, you know, because you feel validated and, like, gratified. I'm not the only one who's worried about this stuff, you know.
Yes. And, you know, film and art should do that, right?
Yeah. Once in a while.
I think so. You talked about improv. So, who were the biggest improvers? Because you have Jillian Bell, who I love, Michaela Watkins.
Oh, all of them. I mean, every single one is an improv genius. That was the only reason they ended up in this movie. Because I've discovered over the past few years that some of my favorite actors in the world cannot improvise very well. It's not, and they have a whole other magic ability to take the written word and make it seem like their own, like it's just coming out of, but they need text, pre-written text for the spine of their performance. Nothing wrong with that. But in order to make a movie like this, in the 12 days that I had to make the movie, I needed to have masters of the craft. And every single person in that cast is a genius at improvisation. It's just, I mean, I couldn't have done it without one. If one of them had fallen down on the job, I would have been screwed. But yeah, I really lucked out. I mean, it was carefully curated. They were all vetted, you know, either I worked with them directly or they highly vetted, you know, the other people. So yeah, I mean, I can't even, it's so fun. I never get sick of watching this movie because they're of their genius.
Yes. And I also want to talk a little bit about the scene that you did with Mark. Mm-hmm. You played Deirdre in the film. And it's not a huge part, but I have to say, I mean, I know a lot of it's your acting ability, but the restraint in that scene really blew me away. Okay, I'm getting the chills right now. So let's listen to a clip.
So, you owe me dinner. When are you going to come over and cook for me? Have you ever had his guacamole?
Nope.
It is amazing. He's still got a little New Mexico in him.
I don't think that'd be a very good idea.
Fair enough. I'm not letting you off the hook, though, that easy. I'm going to keep trying because you do owe me that fucking dinner.
What's going on, Dee?
Stuck on there.
Really?
It's not for keeps. You can't keep it.
This ring?
What else do I have? It's all I have, and I know you'll keep it safe. It's just collateral. I'm gonna come back for it. With the interest and everything, every last penny. You know I'm good for it. I mean, I swear to God, I'm good for it. You know I am because I fucking love this ring. You know how much I love it.
You're not good for it.
I am, and here's why. Because I have a job. I don't know if you heard. I got a job that is going great. They like me there a lot. They actually, like, you know, they... chance, and really nice to me, and I'm doing good there. My fucking car broke down. I can't get there unless I fix my car, and I don't have any money, and so I just need a fucking loan. Could you just give me a loan? Could you just loan me some fucking... Do you know how hard it is for me to come in here and ask you for this?
So maybe you can tell me about that scene, because to me, it's sort of a masterwork of subtext.
Well, I really appreciate that. I'm very proud of that scene, and mostly I'm relieved that that scene did not ruin the film. I did not. I came from acting. I was a very serious actor in my youth. Started when I was a kid and got a BA in theater as an actor. And then I started to try to make a living at it. I moved from Seattle to New York to try and make a living at it, and I just fell out of love with it. And it was also, I just realized it wasn't the best fit for me, and it wasn't fulfilling all of my creative, expression. And so I moved on. But when I started directing, I years and years later, I fell in love again with acting and fell in love with actors because I'm completely dependent on them to fully realize my work. You know, I absolutely need actors, and working with actors is my favorite thing about directing. Absolutely, I love the edit room too. But doing those two things, I'd say working with amazing actors is just like a little bit higher than that, than editing. I acted in one of my other films, Hump Day, and the experience taught me that I should never do that again. I should never act in one of my own movies. I try to take parts in other people's movies when they ask me to, because I like to remain empathetic with the actors. I always say everybody is working their ass off on set, but nobody has a harder job than the actor. And the ones who are really good at it, make it look like breathing. So it's really easy to forget how hard it is, but it's really, really hard to sort of shut out all of the equipment and all the crew and all the weird artificial experience of where you're at and do your scene, and you have to do the scenes out of order and you have to do the takes again and again and again and make it seem like fresh. And it's really hard and then remain emotionally available that whole time. For me, when I'm acting, if I'm acting my own thing, I have to literally turn off the director part of my brain, because as a director, you need to be looking at every aspect. You need to be thinking about the whole. And when I'm acting, I have to just be in it. And totally just in the character and in the scene and with my scene partner. And I do not understand how people do both at the same time. Like George Clooney, what the hell? I don't get it. I allowed myself to do this. Mike was the one who I was co-writing the script with. He kept putting me on the cast list because we had these actors we knew we wanted to work with. And so we, for a while, it was just the actor names and we were coming up with their character names later and figuring out who they were going to be. And he kept putting my name on the list. And I was like, Mike, I'm not going to be in the movie. I don't do that anymore. I don't do that. It's my rule. And he kept saying, you have to be. He just insisted I had to be in the movie. I'm going to be in the movie. You have to be in the movie. So I was going to be like, there's this one character who comes in to get to, like, she had pawned her coat so that she could get some money, and she's picking up her coat. I thought it was literally going to be like a 10-second scene. I was like, okay, finally. I finally relented, and I said, well, I've always wanted to play a junkie, so maybe I could... Maybe I could come in and just, you know, pick up something I'd pawned or try to pawn something to get some money for some junk. And then we realized as we were writing that Mel, the main character played by Marc Maron, needed an emotional arc, and we needed some way to track his emotional arc and some sort of way to begin and somewhere for him to end up. And we just realized that, oh, maybe this could be a character who could help us do that. And she doesn't really have to show up that much. She could just have really one main scene. And then he sees her one more time sort of in the distance. And I thought there was going to be one more opportunity to do that, but I ended up cutting it out of the movie. But he refers to a lot. You know, he refers to her and this backstory that he and I developed together. And it just sort of happened again very organically. I had a tremendously wonderful time doing that scene. And it really felt great. It made me want to act more. It was really like, wow, this is really, feels really good. But as a filmmaker, it's like, you're just, for me anyway, I'm just terrified that I'm going to ruin my movie, because if I'm not doing that much, right? I mean, I'm not doing it that much. You get rusty. And I just had no idea if I would be able to actually pull it off. And if I hadn't been able to pull it off, I would have been screwed, because that is a scene that cannot be cut out of the movie. So I'm mostly just deeply relieved when I see it and when people say, oh, you did a good job, because I'm just like, okay, thank God, you know, because yeah, I don't think it would have. And it ended up being such a seminal part of his story that you really needed to say a lot. Now, in terms of the subtext, I'm a big, big fan of not over expositoring. How do you say that? Of over exposition. I really hate over exposition. I hate it. I like to have a lot of backstory. I like, for especially for an improvised movie, I want everybody who comes onto that set to know exactly who they are to each other, if they have a pre-existing relationship. So I got Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins to spend time together and figure out where they met and how they met and what their hopes and dreams were if they got this money and all that stuff, and who the characters are, what their individual backstories are. And the same with Mel and Deirdre. We knew who these people were, who they were to each other. We had all of that figured out. And ideally, and that scene, I have to say, is kind of a perfect example. As soon as he sees her, she comes into the shop, he's in the back, and she's sort of talking to his employee, Nathaniel, played by John Bass. But as soon as Mel enters the shop and she says, oh, nice boots, and he notices her, there's immediately a heaviness that enters the room. and the way he looks at her and the way his whole body language shifts, you know there's like some deep ass history between them. And that's what I love the most, is when you feel the history and you feel the chemistry between these people without a word being spoken. That's my favorite. And just, and I tried to make, that scene actually was very written out. So some scenes were not at all, and I let them find the way, their own way for the beats of the scene. This was really written out. I'm not sure why I did it that way, but every line that Mel says was written. And my takes, Deirdre coming in, and she sort of does the song and dance, trying to get him to give her money. And mine were looser. My side of the scene was a little looser because every take was a little different. But he could always, the rejoinders were always the same. Like, he's just stonewalling me. But I really, really wanted it to be, I wanted there to be some mystery. I wanted you to really feel what the history was, but not know every detail, and that was okay, you know? And then later you find out more.
Yes, and again, that's a lot of restraint and a lot of subtext, and it was so good. And the first thing I did after I watched the film was rewind and go back and watch that scene again. And it broke my heart. Part of it, too, is usually you see a scene, a character like her, maybe in her teens or 20s, but these are two people who have lived lives, and it's just so fragile, you know, in that moment. And that's, like you said, about a pawn shop. Like, anybody can walk into that pawn shop. You know, some people hey, I found a sword. Some people, I need a few bucks. You know, I need to get to work. And mm-hmm. I thought that it was really powerful for me.
Thank you.
And a lot of young writers, I think, feel like they have to explain and do the exposition. Because you could have said, you know, I can't give you money. You're going to go buy drugs. You know,
right.
Could have done that. But you didn't. And I was just so happy because it made me wonder and look forward to like what was happening.
Yeah, I think the closest I came to that was saying, it's not what you think. It's not what, you know, I'm asking for money and begging for money.
Yes.
And I've told him why and what I'm going to use the money for to fix my car. But I'm like, he's saying, I'm not the Salvation Army. Sorry, not going to do it this time. This time, he says, you know, she's done it before. And you know, you can feel her shame, I hope, you know, and the courage and that, like, she doesn't want to be there, but she has no choice. She hands over a ring and he says, really? This ring? And you just know, it's like, okay, obviously, like, he gave it to her. There's some history with this ring. Obviously, he must have given it to her. He's really hurt that she wants to just pawn it. And she's saying, no, but I'll come back for it. I swear to God, you know how much I love this thing. And you feel so much. I mean, I'm very proud of that scene. And then the closest I come to saying that, you know, that she's a junkie, I mean, the fact that he's also completely stonewalling me, you get the sense that, you know, that there's some reason for that. She's like, it's not what you think, it's not what you think. And he's just like, uh-huh, yeah, sure. And so, you know, she's lied to him. I mean, there's so much you can read into it. And what I love about directing a scene like that, writing and directing a scene like that, is instead of spoon-feeding the audience exactly what is going on, what the motivations are for each, you know, character to act the way they're acting, is that if you do that, they become passive. And they might check out a little. But if you can just give them these breadcrumbs of, you know, hints about, intriguing little hints about what's going on. If you see these two people acting in a really specific way with each other and you're like, what is up? It makes you lean forward in your seat as a viewer, and it makes you become an active participant because you're trying to put the pieces together. And that's my absolute favorite thing. So in the edit room, I'm always trying to find, I mean, it happens at every stage, but in the edit room, it's always that balancing act. Like, how much can I keep it mysterious and keep them interested and intrigued without completely making it so opaque and confusing that they just shut down and like, well, I give up. I don't know what's going on. You know, what is happening between these two people? I'm too confused. So it's that balance. It's always a balance of like, how much do you give them and how much do you hold back?
Also, as a testament to your acting, when I rewatched the scene, I could tell on your face the moment when you knew it's not happening. Again, well done.
Thank you.
You mentioned studying theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we did? Yeah. I have this theory that actors, because you study plays and the great playwrights, actually are kind of natural screenwriters if they want to be.
Yeah.
Do you think that?
I mean, it definitely helped. I had this very long, circuitous, unorthodox film school that I didn't even know was a film school, because I came to making movies. I was 39 when I directed my first film, and now 13 years later, I've made 8, which just blows my mind. But I always loved movies. I always loved the idea of directing them. I was always intimidated by it. I didn't know anything about it except that it cost millions of dollars, and I didn't want to be responsible for other people's millions of dollars because I knew it would be my millions of dollars. The whole thing just freaked me out. And I just had to really grow comfortable in my own skin and sort of grow up and you know, learn about who I was and become more confident in myself before I could even consider doing it. But I also, along the way, didn't even realize that I was following a path of a pretty well-designed film school, which was that I started as an actor in the theater, and like you said, I studied play after play after play, and I acted in a lot of plays, and I got to feel what it felt like to tell a story from organically from beginning to end, which is not something that actors get to do in movies or TV. Rarely, if ever, you get to actually act an entire story from beginning to end. You just don't get to do that. But when you do plays, you get to do that. Like, you get to really feel the arc of each scene and building up to the arc of the whole story from, you know, beginning, middle, and end, which I think gets in your bones. I think you feel it. Like, I never read a screenwriting book. I never did that. But I feel like if you look at my movies, they really are pretty classically structured. And that's how stories come to me as well. So there was that. And then I ended up, when I kind of put that off to the wayside, I transferred my addiction, because it really was like an addiction, to photography. And I ended up building up a body of work of photography, which I then, for a couple of years, taking classes at the International Center of Photography. I was living in New York at the time. And then I applied to grad school, and I got into the School of Visual Arts, and I have an MFA in photography, which is where I really was playing with what I like to see in the frame, and what are lenses and lighting and all that stuff. And then I also started playing with film and video, but as a solo artist. So I was, and as a pure artist, like, I wasn't thinking, I was making films and videos and experimental films, experimental documentaries, but I wasn't thinking about an audience. I wasn't thinking about anything but expression, really. And I was editing, I was sound designing, I was doing everything on my own. And then my marketable skill was editing. So then for many years I was editing, and I came to Seattle back from New York and was a sort of a bigger fish in a small pond. And I ended up editing a couple of features and several narrative shorts. And that's when I realized, oh, I'm ready. Ready. I feel ready to lead the team, you know. And I'm also, I feel like I have all the skills I need. So it was like acting, photography, editing was sort of a perfect, you know, trifecta of a background.
That's amazing. So I'm old enough to have seen sort of indie film, or the business of indie film, kind of be really successful and then kind of fall down a little bit. So I'm sure you've seen all the trends happen. Do you have any advice? Say I'm working on an independent script right now. Do you think, is there anything advice that you can give me as to what I should do?
Well, I mean, the road that I have taken, only one of my films has been a multi-million-dollar endeavor. The others have all been pretty cheap, sometimes really cheap, and sometimes, you know, cheaper. And the advantage to having a film that you can make, now, not every narrative can be told this way, but if you can come up with a narrative that intrigues you and that you can really get behind, you can tell some really compelling stories. If you take a look at Hump Day or Your Sister, they're great examples. There's a lot of love for those two movies. They're streaming somewhere in the world. and they're great examples of smaller stories that can be told well and can really compel an audience and can make a big impact. I mean, Hump Day made it possible for me to make a living doing directing. And I could have, if I'd been a writer, I could have, you know, it gave me reps, and I could have become a writer and a script doctor, but I'm just not that kind of writer. I only like to write things that I'm gonna make myself. But the point is that making a movie script that can be producible with a minimal number of, I mean, my formula is fewer scenes where more things take place, fewer characters, fewer locations. And that all adds up to you know, I was 5 days in the pawn shop, for instance. We pre-lit that place, and there was very little time spent. You know, we did tweak the lights depending on the setup, but there was very little time spent lighting once we were all set up in there. So that means you're just rolling the cameras, you know, as much as you possibly can. And the fewer locations means you don't need as huge a crew or as many trucks, because you're not dragging equipment from place to place to place or wasting time doing that. You know, so those are all ways that you can reduce the number of days you have to feed people, the number of crew you have to use, you know, to really tell a story well. So the cheaper, the better, because in this day and age right now, it's like people want to spend $200 million on a tentpole movie and nothing else. Like, to get an adult drama made, you know, in the $8 to $15 million range is really tough right now. Really tough. But if you can make something even cheaper that, you know, and you can finagle a couple of names to attach, you know, and I don't have any superstars in my movie, but I definitely have people who are working actors and have fans. It really, and a great comedian podcaster, an interesting personality who has a lot of fans, that helps a lot too. But it really, it's amazing. Even if you have unknown people, you can get into a film festival, you can actually get a little traction, and you're not going to have to sort of burn all your bridges. Like, it used to be that if you wanted to make an indie film, you would max out credit cards and beg, borrow, and steal, and like sort of just, you know, bulldoze as all the opportunity, all the resources that you had at your disposal. And then to try and make a second one was impossible because it was so expensive back when you had to shoot on film, you know, and everything was so expensive. But now, I mean, literally people are shooting on their iPhones. I don't recommend that you necessarily go that route because you really have to know what you're doing to do a good job of that. But, you know, the point is you can really, with the equipment itself is minimal, to make really beautiful looking movies. So find your tribe, you know, and try to come up with stories, even if you want to make some big period, you know, like save that for when you're actually up and running and known, you know, but for now, like try to come up with stories that could be told cheaply, but without cheating the narrative, and just do it, you know, and then learn as you can, because then if it's not that expensive, then nobody has to be the wiser. If it is a failure, you should be allowed to fail. You know, failing is an important part of the learning process, right? Right.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Again, this movie is fantastic. Please go see it. And I hope I get to talk to you again.
Oh, it was a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.